And our next conversation may not be appropriate for some children, even though it's been in the news a lot recently. It's the business of making babies. A 33-year-old lawyer from Boston recently found out he's spawned more than 70 kids after donating to a sperm bank during his 3 years at law school. Some of those kids are speaking out, tracking down donors through a website and airing concerns about the possibility of accidental incest. And then there's the European sperm bank Cryos International. They announced a moratorium on sperm from red-headed donors because they have 140,000 doses in stock and apparently they're not selling. How does the fertility industry work? Who monitors it? How big is it? Renee Almeling is a professor of sociology at Yale. Her new book, Sex Sells, C-E-L-L-S, The Medical Market for Eggs and Sperm. Renee, professor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So to the most sensational question first, we're hearing anecdotal stories of kids meeting other kids, say, in college, and finding out through these new online registries that they are siblings through a sperm donor. Now, does the industry track donations to make sure children of the same donor don't have what they are now calling accidental incest? Has there been any case of that?
So right now in the United States, the market for sperm is a wide open market that actually has very little regulations placed upon it. And so whenever stories come out in the news about a donor with 70 children, or actually the New York Times was reporting about a week ago a donor who had 150 children,
right,
the immediate response is to call for new regulations, more regulations. But I think it's important that we actually take a step back and, first of all, find out what exactly is going on in the market. There is no regulatory body in the United States that actually tracks how many donors there are, how many donations they produce, how many children are conceived from sperm donations. So we have just a basic lack of information about what is going on in the market. And so I would say before we would sort of jump into regulations, we need to first figure out the lay of the land to figure out what exactly is happening. And that requires basic data collection.
Sure. And the young people have started doing that themselves, as we've just said, that, you know, they have these online registries. So, you know, to the question, I suppose if there had been a case, we might hear about that. That would be pretty sensational. But on the other hand, we may not know if there had been a case because, as you said, we don't know who these children are. So start with what kind of organizations are there involved with the industry right now?
The Food and Drug Administration, so the FDA, does have regulations about certain diseases that must be screened for in the sperm donor population. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so the CDC, does track the number of fertility programs in the United States, how often they offer in vitro fertilizations, how often they do egg donations, but there's no equivalent tracking of how many sperm donations there are. So there are federal regulatory bodies that are in place that would be able to collect the kind of statistics that I'm talking about in terms of how many donors, how many vials is each donor producing, how many children result from those donations. But that would need to be sort of tracked in a systematic way. What you're referring to is a website called Donor Sibling Registry, which first opened about 10 years ago, and there are now tens of thousands of people who have joined that website. And the people who are on there are children who were born from sperm donation and egg donation, who actually know that they were born from sperm donation and egg donation. In a lot of cases throughout the 20th century, this was very secretive and quiet, and so many parents didn't tell their children. So
right,
you have a number of kids who don't even necessarily know that one of their biological parents was a donor. So donors are finding that website, the offspring are finding that website, and so that's where we start to hear stories of groups of half-siblings that number, you know, between 70, 100, and 150. But those are the big shocking numbers, and my question would be, well, if there are tens of thousands of sperm donations in the country that happen every single year, then what proportion actually produce kinship groupings of that scale?
Right. And we should say there are also advisory groups. There's the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, the American Association of Tissue Banks, groups mm-hmm. that issue recommendations and guidelines so that you can get this government accreditation. But compare the U.S. to the U.K., to Britain.
Well, the United States is an outlier when it comes to reproductive technology in that we have so little regulation. And that really is part of our, in general, we have a very laissez-faire approach to regulation in our country. And that's in stark contrast to Europe and many other industrialized nations that do a lot more in terms of making not only guidelines for the fertility industry, but requirements for how that industry runs. And so in Britain, they've recently outlawed the use of anonymous donations. So now donors have to be willing to be known to the offspring. They've had varying regulations in terms of payment over the years, but they're now in a situation where the payment levels are extremely low, whereas in the United States, we have no regulations around payment. And you mentioned the American Society for Reproductive Medicine in the United States, but that's actually a professional association, just like the American Medical Association
right.
is. So they certainly issue guidelines or recommendations, but they have no enforcement authority to actually make sure that those are enforced.
Whereas to be clear, in the UK, the Human Fertilization and Embryo Authority is a government-authorized licensing and regulation authority. So all the clinics in Britain are required to abide by these government practices.
Right. And that body originally grew up out of the initial concerns about reproductive technologies that were being raised in the 1970s and 1980s as in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, egg donation were really coming to the fore. And so Britain said, you know, they really wanted to get ahead of those technologies and put into place a system of evaluating the technologies and making recommendations and guidelines for them, even before they really sort of took over. Whereas in the United States, we're in a situation where people and physicians and consumers use the technologies, and then the law plays catch up later on through lawsuits and things like that.
Well, isn't that the way some Americans want it? This is very private business. You know, many Americans may not want the government knowing who their children are that come from these donations. Is it a privacy issue in the United States?
There is no question at all that Americans are notoriously reluctant to regulate reproduction, and for good reason, I would argue. If we look historically, there has been pretty dark history in our nation when it comes to federal agencies telling people who should be reproducing and who should not be reproducing. There are eugenic laws that go back to the 1920s and 1930s, and those kinds of regulatory pushes really get shot through with gender inequalities, with racial inequalities. And so there's a pretty dark history of that in our country, as in other countries. And so there's a reason that people are reluctant to regulate reproduction. And it is in part because they do consider it a private matter. So I think that's why, you know, when I hear a sperm donor with 150 children and the immediate call is for more regulation, that's why I think it's important to sort of take a deep breath and take a step back and say, we need to know more about what this industry looks like before we sort of jump in. And then we need to think very, very carefully about what regulations would make sense and that we would be comfortable with as a society.
Renee Almeling is a professor of sociology at Yale. Her new book is called Sex Sells, C-E-L-L-S. And Renee, you've been telling us about how little the U.S. regulates this industry, but let's go back to where it all started. You track it to 1909 with a doctor writing an article about something that happened to him in medical school.
Yes, and Dr. Hard told the story of being a medical student who was with his class observing a physician in Philadelphia when the physician was approached by a couple who said that they were having a lot of difficulty conceiving a child. And the doctor asked the best-looking member of the medical student's class to provide a sample, but he didn't tell either member of the couple what he was doing. So he called the woman in under the guise of saying, you know, I'm going to do an examination. He administered chloroform to her and inseminated her with this medical student's sperm sample. And 9 months later, she gave birth to a healthy baby boy.
Did he ever tell her?
So he never told the woman, but he did, in fact, tell the gentleman in the couple at some point later down the road. It's not exactly clear when, what he had done. Both decided not to tell the woman. So fortunately, we are no longer in a situation
yeah.
where women are being inseminated without their knowledge or without their consent. But there's different threads in that story that I think really do speak to the trajectory of sperm donation through the 20th century. And one of those things is really the central power and authority of the medical profession in organizing this particular reproductive practice.
Well, and it progressed, and it's, as you said, it's a 100-year history. So in the interest of time, we're just going to advance it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, it was, you know, sort of a boutique industry, med students generally donating. And artificial insemination is the much easier, if you will, of these processes. I mean, this we're not talking in vitro fertilization. This is something that, you know, let's be frank here, couples can do with a turkey baster.
Right.
So this was what was happening. But in the 80s, it went to more mass manufacturing and men giving so many donations. What happened?
When I interviewed the founders of some of the first commercial sperm banks in the United States, what they pointed to was the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. And this is a direct quote from two different interviews I did with two different founders, they both referred to AIDS as a key moment of market expansion.
Hmm.
And that's because all of a sudden with the AIDS epidemic, it didn't make any sense anymore to take fresh sperm samples and put them directly into a woman because of the risk of transmitting HIV. And so it became necessary to freeze sperm for at least 6 months so that the donor could be retested 6 months later for HIV. And so technologically, when you start freezing sperm, that really instituted a huge change in how the industry sourced sperm.
Because when you freeze the sperm, it loses its power, and you have to have that much more. So suddenly you have men who are required to be donating once a week for a year. Suddenly it's a big investment. And that's where we are now with this huge industry. But I just want to make sure that we've also talked to you about how different it is for men and women. You know, obviously, biologically, we know that it's different. But the marketing approach is so different. Men who, you know, in the flyers that are sent around to college kids are told, hey, you know, get paid to do something you're going to do anyway. Sorry about the language. And women are marketed to as if they're going to give a gift. You know, don't even think about the money because this is something they feel they're helping a couple with.
Right. So sperm donors are told this is a job. You need to show up on a regular basis. You need to clock in. You need to clock out. Your sperm count needs to be at a certain level, et cetera, et cetera. And egg donors are told what you're doing is helping people create families.
And it's much harder for the women. They have to give themselves injections. It's a very different process.
Yeah, so egg donors will self-inject fertility medications once or twice a day for several weeks, and then they have to go through outpatient surgery. So there's no question there's much more physical risk associated with egg donation. But it doesn't necessarily, that sort of biological difference doesn't necessarily explain why providing an egg to a family who wants to have a child should be a gift, while providing sperm for a family to have a child should be a job. And I think that part of why we see those differences in how it's marketed is because of our gendered stereotypes of women as nurturing and interested in the family, and men as productive members of our society who go out into the marketplace and are the breadwinners.
Yeah.
I think these are 1950s stereotypes that are showing up in the brave new world of assisted reproduction.
When you talk to these people, they're mostly young. These clinics get set up right near colleges. Do they regret this years down the line? Do some of them wonder, wow, is there someone that has, you know, a piece of my soul in them? How do they think about it after they've done it?
This was one of the other really interesting and surprising findings of the study, is that in general, I found that sperm donors had a very straightforward view of themselves as fathers to these children, whereas egg donors were absolutely adamant that they were not mothers.
And I was reading some of the quotes because some of them understood that mothering was a 24-hour process. It wasn't just a donation of an egg. They seemed to assign to mothering nurturing.
Right. Egg donors will say, you know, I just gave the egg. Somebody else is going to carry the pregnancy, is going to give birth, is going to raise the child, and that person is the mother. Whereas sperm donors aren't doing, they're not saying, well, I gave just the sperm, so I'm not the father. And I think what that points to is that we still have a cultural equation in which providing the sperm makes somebody a father in a way that providing an egg doesn't necessarily make someone a mother.
You know, what are some of the questions? Just lay them out. What are the questions we need to take away? Maybe we don't have the answers, but what are the questions about the fertility industry?
As the fertility industry is placed under more and more scrutiny, it's going to be really important to get some really detailed information about how the industry works, really basic information. How many sperm donation programs are there? How many donors do they have? How many donations do each of those donors produce? How many children result? These are really basic questions that we don't have the answers to. And I think to take a more sociological approach, as these children find each other, as donors find out that they have, you know, a number of children out there, I think it's really going to result in us continuing to question our definitions of the family and what makes a family.
Renee Ameling, professor of sociology at Yale. Her new book, again, Sex Sells, C-E-L-L-S, The Medical Market for Eggs and Sperm. Renee, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.